This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Trains are making a comeback in America, but our vast highway network nearly killed the railroads, according to my guest Stephen Goddard. He says the belief that the railroads merely yielded to a more advanced form of travel is a myth. In his new book, he tells the story of how the highway industry and the motor industry got the government to promote driving over train travel. He says it's a saga filled with high ideals and craven conspiracy, inspiration, and myopia. Goddard is the author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. He describes the highway and automobile special interests as the highwaymen.
The highwaymen have existed for approximately 75 years, and they are really an agglomeration of the automakers, big oil, the tire makers, glass makers, anyone who really has profits to be made from the sale of motor vehicles and highways. So in the post-war years, added to that were the hotel industry and motel industry, restaurants, fast food chains, anyone who could profit from this. They coalesced in the World War I era. And interestingly enough, railroads helped do themselves in because railroads had poisoned the well of public opinion by the depredations of the robber baron era. And so they and government were sworn enemies. This made it more easy for government to join hands with the highwaymen. And indeed, this has been a public-private partnership ever since. And its essential strategy, which is very sophisticated and has been to sell to three generations of Americans the notion that cars and trucks are good and railroads are bad. Now, that sounds very simplistic, but it's pretty on target.
So there was a partnership, you say, between people who built the roads and the government, whereas the government and the railroads were enemies earlier in the century. Why were they enemies?
They were enemies because from the very beginning, the railroads viewed themselves as, correctly, as the world's first big business. Consider that in the 1880s, their collective revenues were many times that of the United States government. And one of the reasons the government moved to regulate them is that this was an industry growing like a cancer, and they were afraid that if it wasn't stopped, that the railroads could take over the entire United States. Indeed, in the Western expansion, they practically created the and owned the states that were settled out in the far west through the railroad land grants. The railroads, being the individualistic capitalists that they were, felt that any partnership or cooperation with the government would smack of socialism, and they were not about to have that. They didn't need government telling them what to do. They knew best. I don't think there's any question that the railroads brought on the enmity of the government. Even after the Interstate Commerce Commission was formed in 1887 and they began to turn the screws, it would have been possible for the railroads to say, okay, let's sit down and talk, maybe we can work something out. But they were always too proud and too arrogant and too individualistic to do that. And so consequently, the standoff continued.
Do you think that the design of America's highways was intended to hurt the railroads?
It wasn't intended directly to hurt them, although they were a necessary scapegoat in order for the highway motor complex to get the appropriations out of Congress and state governments that they needed. It was helpful to have railroads as, if you will, the bête noire, the enemy that had done damage to America. And indeed, if you look at the early years of the century, when magazines, the famous 10-center magazines, would run exposés, Ida Tarbell, Lincoln Steffens, people of this ilk, attacking the railroads, many of these articles were funded by members of the highway motor complex, so that to say that the highwaymen intended to kill off the railroads is somewhat simplistic. To say, however, that they used the railroads as a scapegoat and to advance their own causes is more correct.
What was the railroads' response to the building of all the highways?
The railroads, incidentally, thought that the highways were the best things ever in the early years. Back in the teens, they crusaded, believe it or not, for good roads. Their theory was that if you could have smooth roads from the farms to the depot, it would help them speed produce, and they could carry more farm produce, which would give them more revenue. Even into the 20s, the notion that a trucking industry could arise that would challenge them was simply not accepted at all by the railroads in general. As early as 1916, some people within railroads, more visionary people, started smelling a rat that the trucking industry was going to be a potential competitor. But the conventional wisdom within railways was that it would never happen. A, cars and trucks were too flimsy. They were rather primitive conveyances at that time, and they could never go long distances. And secondly, the roads, even the newly paved roads, were bad. But what they had underestimated was that here the trucking industry was an industry of easy entry, where people could come in, and because they were their own boss, they would work in under hours and conditions that an employed person wouldn't. And so pretty soon, within a few years, they were going hundreds of miles, and the handwriting was on the walls that the railroads had a major and potent competitor.
My guest is Stephen Goddard, author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephen Goddard, author of Getting There. How does the American railroad system compare to European countries?
Well, first of all, the European countries have a long tradition of owning their rail systems. This does not mean that they were visionaries. It means that they did so for reasons of security back in the 19th century, because with enemies arrayed along their borders, a government could not take the risk of having their primary transportation system owned by private industry, and so they nationalized them. This gave them a built-in stake, Terry, in making sure that when highways came, that they maintained a balance with the railroads so that the rails would not be overwhelmed. As a result, today, the European rails are in much finer shape than we are, and they also are integrated with both road and air travel in a much closer way than we are. They work as one system, whereas our modes, air, sea, rail, road, work in a vacuum, one from the other.
What do you mean they work as one system?
Well, they are through, and this differs from country to country, but there's much more effort to plan the integration of the system, so that you might see, for instance, in a European country, you might board a train in a large city, let's say Munich, and you go to Frankfurt, and you at Frankfurt you want to go directly to the airport and fly home to Kennedy Airport. Well, you put your bags in, you check them in at Munich, and you never see them again till JFK, because road and air work together so that, first of all, the train goes directly to the airport, which is a rarity in America, and then the luggage is checked over and heads home. Now, that kind of integration also exists more and more in Europe in freight travel as well. And that's one of the critical problems with America, is that the absence of that kind of integration creates a kind of inefficiency that puts us at risk in global competition, where the key is to move freight as quickly as possible from point A to point B.
What else do you think America should learn from Europe's trains?
Well, that passenger rail can pay, first of all. The French system, the TGV, particularly the one that goes from Paris to Lyon, has racked up a 15% profit in the 15 years that it's since it was built. And of course, this goes against the grain of the conventional wisdom that passenger rail can't pay. This is a luxury service. It's high speed, goes approximately 185 miles an hour, and with amenities that we don't have here. Now, fortunately, and I think your readers, your listeners should be aware of this, that the American rail system through Amtrak is going to offer the same kind of speed and convenience, well, not quite as much speed, but certainly the convenience and the amenities within about 3 years when they put on the Northeast Corridor from Washington to Boston, a futuristic amalgamation of several European concepts into one American-made and manufactured train, which will go about 150 miles an hour and will have such things as hot meals on board and video consoles in the seat back in front of you, the kinds of things that Europeans have grown used to, and we're going to have it here.
In the earlier part of the century, you say that the railroads and the government were enemies, and everybody just really hated the railroads for acting like robber barons.
Yes.
But with Amtrak, there's a new kind of partnership now between the government and the railroads. What exactly is the nature of that partnership, and where do you see that in the period of history that you're writing about the rails and the roads?
The difference is, I think, that the government created Amtrak rather than the passenger rail system being a private entity.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they have a stake in seeing that it succeeds in the same manner that Europe has a stake, its countries have a stake in seeing that its passenger rail succeeds because they own the system.
So you think Amtrak has been a good development?
I think it's been a very good development. And it's going to get better to the extent that it can develop the volume it needs. Volume is everything to rail. And you're only going to develop volume when Americans are able to shake themselves loose of this cultural gridlock that says that they have to go everywhere by automobile and nowhere by train.
Why did you start writing about roads and rails?
I'd have to go back about 45 years, Terry, to tell you that. It draws together a number of threads of life experience. When I was a little boy in the 40s, my folks took me to New York on the early diesel trains in the days when you could have hot meals prepared on board in fancy dining cars rather than plastic pre-wrapped sandwiches as you often have today. Then in the 50s, as a teenager, I cruised the brand new interstates in my new car. Later, as a college student and newspaper reporter in the 1960s, I began to ask why the railroads and the trolleys happened to die at the same moment the superhighways were born. Then I really made a decision that I wanted to live in the cities, and I've been living in Hartford for 30 years. And as a husband and father and a person who works in the city too, I've watched the legacy of the interstates, which were supposed to save the inner cities to bring in people to their downtown commercial centers. In fact, what happened was that they were a two-way street, and they sucked the stable middle class out. So that after all these years of asking these questions, about 6 years ago, I began to go back and try to find the answers, because I thought the conventional wisdom was that this started in the post-World War II era, and my big surprise was that it had occurred much earlier than that, back in the teens, and was the work of the highwaymen were organized even then, and the interstate highways today are something that was on the drawing boards back in the 20s and early 30s.
Well, Stephen Goddard, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Stephen Goddard is the author of the new book, Getting There, The Epic Struggle Between Road and Rail in the American Century. This is Fresh Air.